Morning. Thanks for coming today. My name is Robert Lamb. I'm the director of the Program on Crisis, Conflict, and Cooperation here at CSIS. Welcome. It is my pleasure today to be hosting John Sopko, who's the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, known by the acronym SIGAR. Mr. Sopko has been a state and federal prosecutor. He has been congressional counsel, senior federal government advisor. He has been the chief counsel for oversight and investigations for the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, and has also been on the chief oversight council at the Homeland Security. Under then Senator Sam Nunn, currently CSIS's chairman, he was on the Senate Subcommittee for Investigations staff. He has worked at Commerce, at the Justice Department, at the state and federal level. And today he is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan's Reconstruction. We are now entering our 12th year in that conflict. And I wish that I could report that the reconstruction is complete. Unfortunately, what we do know is that compared to 10 years ago, there has been a great deal of progress in Afghanistan's society and its quality of government. But I think, as we're all very well aware, the reconstruction program has not always gone as desired and as expected. We have military units continuing to rotate into Afghanistan today. We still have many tens of thousands of troops on the ground, and we have what is expected to be now a more rapid troop drawdown from Afghanistan over the next 2 years than I think any of our military planners and reconstruction officials had hoped for or expected. Mr. Sopko has recently returned from a trip to Afghanistan and has just published the first quarterly report of 2013. And we look forward to hearing what he has been finding in Afghanistan and what his views are on the future of the reconstruction program in Afghanistan. Mr. Sopko.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here, and I have to apologize to start with. For those of you who have been in Afghanistan, you get what's called the Kabul crud, and particularly in winter. So I will be trying to speak through that today. It is a real honor to be here today at CSIS. In many ways, it's a bit of a homecoming, and I see some old friends of mine, Judge Webster, Dr. Quartersman, Arnold Dvorskroff back there. I worked for over 15 years for Sam Nunn, who, as Bob mentioned, is the chairman of the CSIS Board of Trustees, as well as with John Hamry for quite a few years when he was working for Sam Nunn. So it's and he's been a tireless leader of CSIS since 2000, so it is a bit of a homecoming. In many ways, those 15 years that I spent with Sam Nunn helped prepare me for my current job. And because there, I saw firsthand what congressional oversight, what fair, what open oversight can do to improve programs and policies of the United States government. This was later reinforced when I had the great opportunity to work with who I think many people have viewed as probably the father of modern congressional oversight, and that was Chairman John Dingell, and ran his investigations for a number of years for him on the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, from both of them, I also learned the important role of an independent and aggressive inspector general, because the statute in 1978 was to create an inspector general who basically told truth to power, even when those who were powerful didn't want to hear it. But both those men, Sam Nunn and John Dingell, fully understood the role of and the importance of an inspector general in improving the operations of the United States government. So, to many ways, those two men have brought me to where I am today. It has been only 7 months, however, since I was appointed by President Obama as the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. Since then, I've traveled twice to Afghanistan. I've spoken to all the major players, both in and out of the government, as well as many of our nation's top policy makers and prestigious think tank experts, including many right here in CSIS and in the audience. I've learned a lot about our government's efforts there, what we've accomplished and what we haven't, as well as the many challenges that still face us in that country. I've also spent a great deal of time thinking about what my role, what my agency's role at SIGAR is in Afghanistan. Let me tell you take a few minutes to tell you a little bit about SIGAR. It's not a well-known organization. It's not something you smoke either. It's a Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction. It is the only agency in the entire United States government whose mission is reconstruction in Afghanistan, nothing else. So we're unique about that. We have the unique authority to examine any project by any government agency operating in Afghanistan dealing with reconstruction. So we can look at the Department of Defense, Department of State, AID, Department of Justice, any agency operating in Afghanistan. That's unique. We have the largest oversight presence on the ground in Afghanistan. We have the most aggressive suspension and debarment program in Afghanistan. And we have the most successful record of working with Afghan law enforcement in prosecuting, arresting, and prosecuting individuals in Afghan courts. Now, we are a temporary agency. We go out of existence. We sunset when reconstruction drops below $250 million in unexpended funds. So we have a way to go. We're in the billions right now. Accordingly, we have some very unique hiring and contracting authorities, unique to the government, that allows us to get the best people as quickly as we can for what I think is the most dangerous oversight job in the United States government. When Congress created SIGAR in 2008, it also gave us the responsibility and the authority in the statute to lead, coordinate, and recommend policies to improve the Afghanistan reconstruction effort. Accordingly, I believe it is our job to evaluate the bigger picture and offer direction as necessary and appropriate on the reconstruction effort. Now, just last Wednesday, Bob alluded to the fact I returned from Afghanistan. I try to visit Afghanistan every quarter. Everyone there, I can assure you, in the embassy and in the military, is intensely focused on the difficult task of transferring security responsibilities to the Afghans by the end of 2014. And equally interested and concerned about strengthening the Afghan government's ability to manage the country's continued reconstruction efforts during this transition period and beyond. I think it is fair to say that the success or failure of our entire investment in Afghanistan is teetering on whether these two interrelated and ambitious goals can be met. And I have little doubt, especially from speaking to all of the major leaders in my latest trip, that the men and women responsible for taking on this challenge are acutely aware of that situation. Likewise, the newly installed 113th Congress have the responsibility to ensure that the next stage of our nearly $100 billion decade-long reconstruction effort is properly directed toward those activities and projects that will have the greatest opportunity of long-term success. In light of my role as the Special Inspector General and our unique mission and mandate, today I want to pose to you a set of 7 fundamental questions that I believe need to be asked of every ongoing and planned reconstruction project by both Congress and the executive branch in order to ensure their success and the ultimate success of our mission in Afghanistan. The first question is, does that project or program make a clear and identifiable contribution to our national interests or strategic objectives? The second question is, do the Afghans want those programs or projects, and do they need those programs and projects? The third question is, have those programs or projects been coordinated with our allies, with the Afghans, and internally with our own government. The fourth question we must ask is, do security conditions permit effective implementation and oversight of those projects and programs? The fifth question is, do those programs and projects have adequate safeguards to detect, deter, and mitigate against corruption, which is endemic in Afghanistan? The sixth question we need to ask is, do the Afghans have the financial resources, the technical capability, and the political will to take those programs and sustain them in the next decade ahead? And lastly, have the implementing agencies established meaningful, measurable metrics for determining success, and are they applying them to their own programs? Now, to many of you in the audience, these questions seem simple. And in fact, they are. But unfortunately, what we have found in our work and what the other inspector generals have found in their work is that they are often ignored by those designing and implementing our reconstruction programs. Now, I'd like to take some time in the rest of the speech to explain why I think these questions are important, discuss what our work and the work of the other IGs are doing about them, and share our plans for using these questions in the years to come as we look at reconstruction in Afghanistan. Let's look at that first question. Do the projects and programs make a clear and identifiable contribution to our national interests or strategic objectives? As you are well aware, the United States' primary goal in Afghanistan has been to prevent Afghanistan from becoming once again a safe haven for Al-Qaeda or other terrorist groups to launch attacks against the United States and its allies. Our central tenet of the U.S. campaign to achieve this goal has been the counterinsurgency or COIN strategy, with its three primary phases of clear, hold, and build. However, our work has found instances in which reconstruction programs have failed to achieve this intended benefit, and in some cases, have actually resulted in adverse effects. In April of last year, for example, we released an audit report on the Local Governance and Community Development Program, or LGCD program, which the U.S. Agency for International Development had touted as, quote unquote, the flagship COIN program. The primary goal of that program was to create, in partnership with the Afghan government, a stable environment for long-term political, economic, and social development. However, as we reported, that the program had not met its primary goal of extending the legitimacy of the Afghan government, nor had it brought the government closer to the people, nor had it fostered stability. In fact, my auditors found that each of the eight provinces with the most LGCD activity experienced dramatic increases in the level of violence between 2006 and 2010. Although the effects of the LGCD program on security levels cannot be isolated, violence data is a useful indicator of stability. And this data certainly suggested that the program was not achieving its intended goals. Likewise, in July of last year, we issued a report on the Afghan Infrastructure Program, or AIP, which Congress created to leverage and coordinate the Department of State, Department of Defense, and AID resources for large-scale infrastructure projects in Afghanistan. We found that five of the seven fiscal year 2011 projects were behind schedule, and that some of these projects may not achieve the positive COIN effects for several years, if at all. We also identified some instances where the projects resulted in the adverse effects because they either created an expectation gap among the populace or lacked citizen support. Now, SIGAR intends to conduct more assessments of programs designed to support the COIN strategy in the upcoming year, including an audit that we will initiate soon on the Stabilization in Key Areas program, which is a $177 million community development program. Likewise, SIGAR intends to increase its focus on in the next year on that second question that should be asked for each reconstruction project. And this is, do the Afghans want it, and do they need it? Now, you'd be surprised how often we find that the answer to this question is no. Let me give you an example. A few days ago, as many of you probably saw in the press, we released an inspection report on a $7.3 million border police facility built in Kunduz province. When our inspectors went to visit the site, they found that it was sitting unused. Although the facility was built for 175 troopers, there was only 12 Afghan personnel on site, and no one was sure among them whether the site was going to be used. Moreover, our inspectors could not even access most of the buildings because they were locked and the border police personnel present did not have keys. Now, there's a bit of good news to Kunduz. As a result of our inspection, the Combined Security Transition Command under General Bolger, which is responsible for these projects, agreed with our recommendations to reassess its plans and determine whether construction contracts can be downsized or facilities eliminated or redesigned. I think this is a great example of how our work can lead to tangible improvements, and I am especially pleased with the continued cooperation of General Bolger and his team in attempting to improve CSTCA's efforts on reconstruction. Now let me turn to another troubling problem, which is in our third question, and that is, has the program or project been coordinated with other U.S. implementing agencies, with the Afghan government, and with other international donors? The border police facility I just mentioned is certainly an example of poor coordination with the Afghan government. But let me give you an example of poor coordination within the U.S. government. In 2011, SIGAR conducted a thorough assessment of U.S. efforts to strengthen the financial sector in Afghanistan and to safeguard U.S. funds that flow through the Afghan economy. We found that even though the Department of Defense and Department of Homeland Security were working with the same Afghan banks, neither agency was aware of the other's efforts. In addition, the Department of Homeland Security had not been included in important interagency working groups designed to coordinate efforts to gain visibility over cash flows. As we reported, limited interagency coordination puts U.S. agencies at risk of working at cross purposes and definitely not benefiting and leveraging existing relationships. The next question I posed is particularly important for SIGAR because it impacts us almost as much as it impacts the agencies implementing reconstruction. And that is whether security conditions permit effective implementation and oversight. Now, although the U.S. combat role is scheduled to end by December of 2014, the withdrawal of U.S. troops is well underway. U.S. and coalition forces have already pulled out of a number of locations in Afghanistan, leaving some of those places too dangerous for us or the implementing agencies to visit. Now, some of you may have heard of what's a term called the golden hour. This refers to the policy unique to only U.S. forces and only in Afghanistan, which in essence says that the military will only provide security in areas within an hour of a facility that can provide emergency medical care. The safe zone, or bubble, around those medical facilities extends about as far as a 20-minute helicopter ride. Now, as the troops continue to withdraw, the amount of territory inside Afghanistan that falls outside these bubbles will increase. Accordingly, the number of U.S.-funded projects and programs that can be monitored and overseen by U.S. personnel will decrease. If we can't get out to review a project or inspect a facility, it is highly unlikely that the agencies funding them can do either, whether it's an agency of the Department of State, Department of Defense, AID, Department of Justice, Department of Agriculture, or any other of the myriad U.S. agencies operating in Afghanistan. This means that more reconstruction projects exist with no direct U.S. oversight. Now, we have already seen the effect of security limitations on the reconstruction effort, as well as on our own operation and that of our colleagues in the oversight and law enforcement community. For example, we reported in 2011 that the World Bank had not conducted site visits outside of Kabul to monitor the activities funded by the multi-billion dollar Afghanistan Reconstruction Trust Fund because of security concerns. Security restrictions are not limited just to the World Bank. Just recently, one of my inspection teams was told that a location in northern Afghanistan was beyond the golden hour, beyond the security bubble, and therefore deemed too unsafe to visit. As a result, we are unable right now to inspect 38 facilities worth approximately $72 million. Now, I want to take this opportunity to personally thank the operations and under the command of Colonel J.R. Bass and the 4th Alabama National Guard, who with Task Force Centurion Prime has done wonderful work supporting us in not only northern Afghanistan but elsewhere in the country, but even they are limited by the security bubble. Now, even in Kabul, we're finding that we cannot always get the protection we need to conduct our work. Although Kabul is clearly within the bubble, the embassy's regional security officer has informed us that because of limited resources, it is already becoming increasingly difficult to support all the requests for movements by U.S. personnel in the Kabul area. Now, despite these restrictions, SIGAR is committed to forging ahead, even under the most severe conditions. I'm very happy to give as an example. Just recently, I learned that two of my agents went out into the field to inspect a particularly dangerous stretch of road as part of their criminal investigation into a contractor's failure to build systems designed to prevent insurgents from placing explosives and culverts along the road. My agents were surrounded by heavily armed U.S. military units who protected them as the agents literally ran down the road from culvert to culvert, inspecting and photographing to see if there was a culvert protection device there and was it adequate. And I'm happy to announce that while I was in Afghanistan, those agents were able to arrest, with Afghan participation, and the Afghan government is charging the contractor who was involved in this with crimes related to the fraud committed upon the government and the negligent homicide of two U.S. personnel. Now, we are developing alternative ways to conduct oversight in Afghanistan's evolving security environment. For example, we have local nationals on our staff who are not subject to the same security restrictions that our American employees are. In some cases, we may have to rely on them. We are also exploring the use of geospatial imaging to assist our oversight. And finally, we will continue to cooperate and work with our other Inspector General's offices there to see if we can combine our activities or come up with best practices to do oversight. These tools are helpful, but they are not perfect. The gold standard, on oversight is a U.S. government employee who's trained to do oversight, going out there and inspecting the site, inspecting the records, kicking the tires. But unfortunately, we may not be able to do that for very much longer in Afghanistan. But I am particularly grateful to Ambassador Cunningham and General Allen for their continued expressions of support for our work. Both promised me during my latest visit that they would ensure that our people would be able to access the same locations that their people can access. But ultimately, you can see, the question is, how far will their people be able to access? What will they be able to see? How far will they be able to go outside of the Kabul bubble? I fear many of our programs will be exposed to increased risk of theft and misuse, especially as we continue to use direct or on-budget assistance to the Afghan government, and especially if we do so without imposing strict preconditions on the Afghan government to permit effective oversight of these funds by U.S. personnel. The next question I posed deals with a different but equally significant problem, namely corruption. Are the reconstruction programs and projects developed and planned to include adequate safeguards to detect, deter, and mitigate corruption? Now, Afghanistan's reputation for corruption is deep-rooted and widespread, and I don't have to devote too much time to that. A recent survey found that 60% of the Afghans believe that corruption is a major problem, and even more believe that is a major problem on their national level. An example of some of the work we had dealing with corruption is one that our Office of Special Projects recently reported on, dealing with currency counters in the Kabul International Airport to count and track bulk cash flows out of Afghanistan. Estimates of cash taken out of Afghanistan in any given year are as high as $4.5 billion. However, although the currency counters were purchased by the United States government and installed in 2011, we found that the Afghan government has refused to use them. Even worse, those identified by the Afghan government as VIPs, or in some cases VVIPs, are allowed to bypass all controls at the Afghan airport, raising the risk of money laundering and bulk cash smuggling. Now, the Afghan government has acknowledged that corruption is a significant problem and has made commitments to curb it. The July 2012 International Donors Conference in Tokyo led to a set of mutually agreed principles that include incentives for the Afghan government to carry out commitments to combat corruption. Unfortunately, we are concerned that not enough is being done quickly enough on these principles, and particularly developing specific benchmarks. It is now almost 8 months since this landmark agreement, and we still have not seen any concrete benchmarks. If not now, when will we see them? I can tell you that as a result of my latest trip to Afghanistan, I will shortly be putting the agencies on notice that both Congress and the American taxpayer need to see concrete steps in place to ensure Afghan government progress to combat corruption and improve governance. If this is not done immediately, I fear we risk the loss of U.S. and international donor support for ongoing reconstruction. Now, corruption can also undermine the sustainability of reconstruction programs, a key concern for the U.S. and other international donors. And this leads me to the next in our series of questions. Do the Afghans have the financial resources, technical capacity, and political will to sustain the reconstruction programs we are funding and turning over to them? Through our audit and inspection work, we have identified numerous examples in which the United States created a program or built a facility without consideration as to whether the Afghan government could sustain it. In October 2012, for example, we reported that the Afghan government will likely be incapable of fully sustaining ANSF, that's Afghan National Security Force facilities, after the transition in 2014. We found that the Afghan National Security Forces lack personnel with technical skills required to operate and maintain critical facilities, and that the Afghan government had filled less than 40% of authorized operation and maintenance positions. Likewise, in 2010, we audited reconstruction efforts in Nangarhar, Afghanistan, and we found that the Afghan government was severely limited in its ability to operate and maintain U.S.-completed development projects in that province. As a result, we found many projects that had become dilapidated or were in disrepair, including a number of projects that had been completed under the Commander's Emergency Response Program, or SERP. And in regards to the SERP program, we were particularly troubled by statements that some senior officials told us that they did little more than check the box in the SERP project files to indicate that the government of Afghanistan agreed to fund sustainment of those programs. Now, the logical result of such policies is a waste of U.S. taxpayer money by building infrastructure or developing programs that the Afghans will never effectively use. My seventh and last question is this: have the implementing agencies established real metrics for measuring success, and are they using them? Too often, we find that the agencies are focused on outputs, not outcomes. For example, they are interested in how many teachers they trained, how many schools they built, how many kilometers of road they built, how many culverts they built, but not on what is the result. Is there any result from doing that? These metrics give us a part of the picture, but they do not truly give us meaningful assessments of whether programs have achieved their goals. For example, in 2011, we assessed efforts to build the capacity of the Afghan Ministry of Agriculture to better serve farmers and promote private sector development. Unfortunately, we found that the U.S. Embassy could not determine how much progress had been made from the project, because all they had done was measured the products of capacity building efforts, such as the number of research stations that had built, the number of research stations that had been rebuilt, the number of labs that had been built, the number of labs that had been rebuilt, rather than the results achieved by the construction. Now, as we proceed with our audit work, we are going to be increasingly looking for ways to go beyond the stated output metrics to assess the impact. What did a project or program actually achieve? If we can't answer that question now, 11 years into the conflict, then why did we spend the money? At the end of the day, the American taxpayer needs to know what the U.S. reconstruction effort has accomplished. Not just output. What is the outcome of all that money spent in Afghanistan? So in sum, those are our seven simple, but we think critical questions. To the extent that agencies can answer in the affirmative to them, we believe that a project or program has a better chance of achieving real success. But if, as in the case of the Afghan infrastructure program, or the border police facility in Kunduz, or the currency counters in Kabul International Airport, the agencies spending our reconstruction dollars find that the answer to these very basic questions is in the negative, is no, it is time for them to reevaluate continuing or starting that project or program. Now, I pose these questions, and I particularly pose these questions in the quarterly report we just issued last week, because we are troubled now. Because we have been told that some of the agencies operating in Afghanistan may be poised to obligate as much money as they can, as soon as they can, before the troop drawdown takes place. If this happens without first assuring that we answer those questions in the affirmative, we are likely to waste billions of taxpayers' dollars. Likewise, it is incumbent upon the Congress to also keep these questions in mind as they review new authorization and new appropriations. And as I mentioned, Congress needs to assure itself that the almost $19 billion already appropriated but not yet obligated, not yet spent, only be spent if they have evidence that the projects meet these seven requirements. Now, obviously, we recognize that there may be projects that do not meet any or all of these seven questions that still need to be funded, because the potential benefit clearly outweighs the inherent risk of failure. But if that is the case, the implementing agencies need to clearly articulate the reasons for doing so, for taking that risk. And Congress needs to hold those agencies accountable to that explanation for why they took that risk. Now, in conclusion, We are about to embark upon a dramatic drawdown in our troop level. At the same time, we are poised to turn over to the Afghan government an unprecedented amount of buildings, projects, and funds, with the hope that they can manage them effectively. This is a risky endeavor, and I believe that strong and independent oversight needs to be an essential part of such withdrawal plans if reconstruction activities are to succeed. At no other time in our decade-long struggle in Afghanistan has reconstruction really been so critical to our ultimate success. Actually, as our military role recedes, the next 2 years and beyond, what some call the decade of transformation, will really be the decade of reconstruction. Therefore, Congress and the executive branch need now to conduct a thorough reexamination of reconstruction issues, programs, and projects. Now, we at SIGAR look forward to the challenge ahead. And I can assure you that we are also committed to the success of the military drawdown and closely working with the implementing agencies to ensure that we embark upon this next critical stage in Afghan reconstruction and ultimate success. Thank you very much to CSIS, to you, Bob, and everyone else for listening. Thank you. I'm open to questions.
Thank you very much. I'm sure there are a lot of questions from the audience. I would only ask that those of you who have a question, please raise your hand. Wait for the microphone, because we are live streaming and recording this event, and your question won't be heard if you're not at a microphone. Please identify yourself, and please make sure you pose a brief question rather than give a speech, because we have a lot of questions and a lot of interest, and we'd like to leave enough time for Mr. Sopko to answer them. So let me start. I'll ask two questions here, and Dr. Cordesman, please, and then I'll take two questions at a time so we can.
Certainly.
Thanks for the talk. I'm Ben Connable with RAND. Very briefly, of those seven questions you asked, I think it would probably be difficult to get an affirmative response for any of those seven for most of the projects that we do. However, a lot of the folks that implement these projects would say that there are intangible benefits that don't demonstrate clear metrics on the back end. They allow for rapport building. They allow access for U.S. forces. So I would ask, first part, are there intangible benefits that you can track and not have to tie everything to quantitative benefits on the back end, and even if those are results-based? And then second part, ostensibly we're switching from counterinsurgency to security force assistance, or already have, and how does that affect your inspection efforts?
And Dr. Cordesman, please.
Tony Cordesman, CSIS. In your first question and in all of your talk, you referred to programs but never to plans. And one of the issues is how you make trade-offs and do you have a coherent way to move forward. I wonder why the focus on programs without looking at plans, when, for example, the Afghan government estimates its aid flow will be cut from $6.4 billion in 2012 to under $800 million in 2014. Even if you get the programs right, if you don't have a plan. And similarly, in your own report, when you looked at the transition plan, there is no plan. There simply is transition, and it isn't tracked to the ANSF. So that's question one. The other refers to measures of effectiveness. You refer to the lack of the measures of effectiveness being issued. But the fact is, a lot of the measures we're using don't really make any sense, like education data, which ignore the actual computer spread and the gap between those data and reality. You have GDP data in your report, but obviously nobody checked it to see if the GDP per capita data you're using tracked between international organizations, which have a 2-to-1 difference. So if we don't actually check the sources for our measures of effectiveness, does it do any good to have measures of effectiveness?
Okay, where should we start on this?
Microphone, please.
Oh.
Press the silver.
Perfect. Okay, I'm not technically capable. Let me try to deal with the first question, and I'll get to Dr. Quartersman's multi-part question, so I'll try to do. On intangible benefits, yeah, we do recognize there are some intangible benefits. Excuse me. But what I was trying to say is that if there are intangible benefits for a program or policy, they should be articulated. And we shouldn't find out after we go into the audit. And I recall one instance where we were doing an audit and some guys, oh, but that our purpose was to do this and this. And what we said, well, we asked you why you were doing it. You gave reasons for why you were doing this program to Congress when you got the appropriation. So we took what your justification was and then applied it. And particularly when we were looking at some of the AIP programs, they had intangible benefits that we couldn't enumerate. And when we said, well, but that's not what you told Congress when you asked for the appropriations. And to some extent, let me just sort of explain the limitation on us in the IG community. I don't do policy. I do not do military policy or tactics. We don't do foreign policy or tactics. We try to look at the process. If you say this is your program, this is your policy, this is the reason why you're doing it, then we see if it's done correctly. Do you meet what you articulate as the reasons for doing it? So I hope that answers that. We do recognize intangible. We do recognize that, and as I said in the presentation, that there may be programs that will not meet any of these questions, but still we should do them. But if so, articulate why. Tell the American people, tell the taxpayer, tell us when we come by looking at the project. Now, turning to Dr. Quartersman, and I hope I get all the respond to all the answers. I should just say yes, I agree. But we are looking at plans, and I apologize if my speech, as I shortened it and spoke, we are looking at some of the planning. And I agree with you. We're having a problem finding out what kind of planning is going on. If anything, this speech is to kind of goad people to, we hope you're doing the planning, and we hope when you're doing the planning, you keep these seven questions in mind. I was just out in Afghanistan asking, are you planning? Can you show us the plans? We haven't seen them. We assume they're there. We're told they're there. We haven't demanded them. Now, each of my sister IGs are looking at the planning process. DOD is looking at the DOD side. State's looking to the state. Aid's going to be looking at their planning process. We're going to be looking at the planning process overall and its impact on Reconstruction. So we are looking at the planning. Is the planning good? I don't know. That's why I wanted to highlight the one particular problem I had, and I had seen this for years, and with Sam Nunn, so I'm not surprised about this, and that is this mad rush to spend money. Plans be damned. We're just going to get that money out the door before the clock strikes 12. And that's my fear, is there is no planning then. You're just pumping the money out the door. So that's what we're concerned about. Now, you talked about the measures of effectiveness and you talked about our data. And I'll be quite honest with you. Some of our data is probably not right. But we get it from the government. Now, I know, okay, I'm from the government. What can you say? But we put out one of the most massive data calls of any U.S. agency every quarter. I have a whole staff that does that. And I've actually asked Dr. Quartersman and anyone else, if we're not asking for the right data, please tell us what data to look for. And I extend that offer to everyone. If it's a reasonable request, we want that data, because part of the mandate and what part makes it us unique, and I didn't mention this when I talked about the uniqueness of SIGAR, we are required not twice a year, but four times a year to do this massive data call. And if you look at our quarterly report, three quarters of the quarterly report is reporting all that data and trying to put some reason behind it. So you go to our quarterly report, it should be the one source, one-stop shopping for information on Afghanistan reconstruction. Now, are there problems with that data? Yes. And that's why we footnote where we get it. And you're right. Some of the data that our U.S. government is using is not the same data the World Bank is using. Some of the data is not the same data that's being used by other of our allies. And we are particularly concerned. And if you look at the last three quarters, I've only been there for three quarters. And the first time I sat down and looked at the quarterly report, and I think, Dr. Cordesman, you and I even had a conversation about that, the data we were getting on the effectiveness of the Afghan National Security Forces. You had doubts, I had doubts. And I told my people to start pulling that string. And this is where actually it's very useful. I mean, I hate to say this, I really rely on you all in the community here in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere who study these issues, because you have the expertise. We're just accountants, investigators, and I use the old line and my staff hates it, I'm just an old poor country lawyer. You know, we know how to do oversight investigations, but you are the experts. But anyway, going back, Dr. Cordesman, you said there was a questionnaire. I thought there was a doubtful questionnaire, and we've been pulling that string. And you'll see in the latest quarterly report, we raised concerns in the second quarterly report I had. We've now raised it again, and we're going to actually dig in to find out what is behind those numbers. Basically, it looks like, and again, we don't know for sure, but we're going to pull that string. It looks like our data on the forces, the Afghan National Security Forces, that we are going to be relying on may be bogus. We don't know what supports it. So we're going to be pulling that string. So I agree with you, and I hope that answers the question. We are open to any suggestions, as well as any criticism of our data requests. And we'd like to make it as broad, as thorough, and as deep as we can. But we can only rely on, and if we don't get the data, I suppose, see, I can't subpoena government agencies, but I can send a nasty letter to their bosses saying they're not helpful to us. It's in the statute. But we're going to try to get as much data as we can so the policymakers on the Hill and in academia and in the policy centers like CSIS have the information to help us all judge and understand and improve our reconstruction in Afghanistan. I hope that answers the question, but I probably dodged it a little. But you did raise that question when I met with you and we followed up.
Let's take two more questions, please, starting here in the front. And then we'll go on this side over here.
Hi. Mark Schneider, International Crisis Group. This is sort of a follow-up to Tony's question. When you look at the milestone rating definitions for the ANSF, one is that they're unable to, that the department or institution exists, but they cannot accomplish the mission. But the second one says that they cannot accomplish the mission without significant coalition assistance. And that one affects many of the entities within the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Interior. And I guess my question is, have you looked at the downward trend in ISAF and U.S. forces, which is providing that assistance, and whether as you move towards 2014, many more of those entities without U.S. and ISAF assistance are going to be unable to accomplish their mission and therefore unable to provide the security that reconstruction requires?
Thanks. And our second question is over here. Please wait for the microphone.
Hi, sir. I just returned from Afghanistan a few weeks ago. And
I'm sorry. Please identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sasha Kishanchand. I don't wish to announce my affiliation because this is a question just based on various experience. But you use terms like results, impact, but it's not clear whether you're auditing bang for the buck on what's being spent and the difference between that and the ultimate impact on how the Afghans perceive the legitimacy of their government, which I think is our ultimate goal in our activities in that country. And so without a clearly stated set of end state rules or however it was standards, I'm not sure how you can ask the implementing partners to be responsible to what you're asking. So I just want to clarify, are you asking for, are you auditing or are you doing monitoring and evaluation of our ultimate impact in the intervention?
Thank you.
Let me start with the ANSF question. And this is a partial answer, I think, also to the second questioner, too. Although we have the largest presence, and I think we have taken the lead on reconstruction, there still are other inspector generals working out there. And so that we try to coordinate our work with the DOD, state, and AID inspector general. Excuse me. So the specific question you asked about ANSF capabilities, DOD IG is looking at that. We are looking at the numbers and how we, what's our process for rating, and we've raised some concerns in prior audits, even before I got there, about what is the standards we're using for rating. We have basically carved out, in conjunction with the other IGs, looking at the support for the ANSF. Now, let me just back up for a second. Why are we talking about ANSF? Because I do reconstruction. You'd say, well, why are you looking at that? Isn't that military? The way the statute and way has been defined, reconstruction includes support, the training, the bullets, the guns, the building, the bases, and all of that, for, and actually the salaries. Of the ANSF. So over 50% of all reconstruction money is really going toward the ANSF. That's how important it is to reconstruction, and security is to reconstruction. So to answer your question, the DOD IG is looking at that. It may be best because that's the territory they've decided to look at. We're looking at a lot of the support for the ANSF, fuel. We're actually doing something on the weapons. We're looking at literacy issues. We're looking at some of the training issues. And as I said, we also are looking at the numbers and where do they get the numbers of how many ANSF troops are actually there and how many have been deserted, how many are they double counting and all that. So we will be looking at that in more detail. So that may answer the question. But it's an important area because over 50% of reconstruction. And if you don't have security, the question about governance, the question about reconstruction pales in comparison if you don't have the security. Now let me turn to legitimacy of the government. That's a big question. That's one of those policy questions like, you know, is the government legitimate? We're not asking that. We're looking at specific audits of programs and policies and procedures. If the program is supposed to support or promote the legitimacy of the government, those are the stated goals that our government has said for this program. We will take that stated goal and then we will audit against it. So in the case of one of the programs that was supposed to bring the government closer to the people and ensure greater support for the central government, I think I referred to one of that audits, we looked at it and said, well, we can't really make certain you did, but violence went up, so we're not certain you accomplished your goal. So I think your question is sort of the penultimate question, which all of our work and the work of the many IGs may answer, and that is about concerning the legitimacy of the government. I hope that answers the question.
Thank you very much. Have you got any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with?
I think it's something I picked up when I was in Afghanistan. I think people keep this in mind. December 2014 is not the end of the world. Doesn't end. Afghanistan will be there, the Afghans will be there, and we will be there as far as we can tell until Congress tells me differently. Not only we, meaning the U.S. government and assistance programs, but I think SIGAR will be there. And we hope to work very closely with our policymakers as well as the implementers to ensure that after 2014, we are successful because we think the next period is really the most important period for reconstruction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sopko, for your words and for your time today. Thank you, everybody, for coming. This video will be posted on the CSIS website. Please go back there and check. And thank you for coming today.